Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening to you all. This is the Business Day Spotlight, your destination for African business made simple. My name is Kudiwa Kabaza, and for today, we're getting deeper into the world of artificial intelligence, that is AI, and we're just going to be talking about some of the big trends that are happening in the space. We are somewhere in Johannesburg. I'm going to call this Rivonia, and we are at a company called Isazi, and we're just going to get a sense of, you know, some of the work that they are doing, and you know, some of what they are seeing, you know, in the AI, machine learning and artificial intelligence space. There's a lot to talk about. I think you know, just over a month ago, there was some big revelations around DeepSeek and, you know, its challenger status, you know, to the likes of Llama, Gemini, as well as ChatGPT in the world of AI. But we're just going to get a sense of how deep this moment is. But before that, we are, as I said, we are at Isazi, and we're joined by Oba Kang, and we're also joined by Dario. And we're going to get a sense of what's happening. Both of them are founders of Isazi. And I think to begin with, I'm just going to allow each one of them to just introduce themselves and then give us a little bit you know, around the company. Oba Kang, let me start with you. Intro, and also just give us a sense of you know, Isazi, what's happening, and then Dario, you know, you can then, you know, tell us so, you know, some of the projects that you guys typically work on.
Great. Thank you very much. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to you listeners. Great for you guys to come to Rivonia and get to know a little bit more about, you know, who we are, what we do. As you mentioned in the intro, my name is Oba Kang Moepia. I'm one of the founders of the company. I basically run the consulting division. So we do a lot of different types of projects within machine learning and artificial intelligence. We've been doing so for probably around 12 years, and we have been engaged in over 200 different projects. So what we aim to do as a company is we use data, machine learning, and AI in order to do two primary things, which is A, reduce a cost in a business process, and B is to increase revenue or find different ways to leverage machine learning and artificial intelligence in order to increase the revenue. So I'll hand over to Dario.
I mean, I'll tell you a little story about how we started, maybe. We, Obi and I, were both lecturers at WITS in 2012.
By the way, as you're talking, right, today was my first time meeting Oba Kang and Dario.
Yeah.
And when I read how the company was started earlier on, I imagined people that were older. I won't even lie, right? And it was because of the lecturing element and, you know, all of that stuff. So, because a lot of the time, you don't find a lot of people that lecture young. You find people that lecture later on. So when I was reading, I was like, oh, okay, cool, you know. Yeah,
we were very young. we were too young. It was students teaching students. I used to walk into the classes sometimes and sit down.
Yeah.
And the person next to me would be like, when do you think he's going to arrive? I'd be like, well, it's me.
Yeah.
So it was awkward. But yeah, we were very young. And I think both of us had this like desire to solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
And academia is great, but one of the things you find yourself doing is getting narrower and narrower into a field, and you don't see the applications. And there was this great opportunity at WITS. It's something that's still run this year. There's a professor there called Prof. Mason. He runs this thing called the Maths and Industry Study Group. And every year they call academics from around the world. They have good contacts in like Oxford and Australia and all over the place. And they call those academics, and then they go to industry. And what I used to do was I used to go and get industrial context for them. And the pitch used to be, hey, you know, we're going to spend a week. We're going to do, we're going to look at your problems and we're going to try and solve them. And you should come to us if you are someone who's tried internally, you've tried with consultants and you're now so desperate, you're willing to let a mathematician have a go at your problem. You know, that's how we used to pitch it. And then they used to send people, and we had all kinds of people coming to this workshop that used to be like, we had the police asking us to optimize roadblocks. We had
SAB.
We had companies coming and asking us to optimize sugar mills. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you spin to get the molasses right? Glass factory came. They were getting bubbles in their glass. How do we like potentially model that furnace with thermodynamics? How do we understand the chemical property that might lead to those bubbles? Mm-hmm. We had like mobile network operators. So it was a really great place to see applications.
Mm-hmm.
And we got massively good feedback there, like, because we used to attend and we used to run some of these little groups. And it was really fun. For 1 week, you'd have lots of coffee, you'd have no sleep. The students and the industry would work together and you would solve something.
Mm. And one of the feedback from the industry group that came to us, it was a glass manufacturing company that said, the solution we actually came up with to reduce the bubbles in the glass furnace actually saved them about 35 million rand a month. In a single month. So, I mean, these were really, really high impact projects that we were taking on at that point in time.
And I think what we realized was the kind of impact we were having there in that 1 week was eclipsing everything else we did the whole year. And so we started asking ourselves, you know, should we start a business to do this full time? That was back in 2012. Partially, like, sometimes when we tell the story, we say we end it there, but sometimes we tell the rest of the story, which is we started the business because the police told us to. So basically what we did was one of the projects we solved was the police were coming to optimize roadblocks, and we told them, don't optimize the roadblocks. Have patrol vehicles that have a phone like an Uber.
Yeah.
And when you drive around, you've got pictures of the different suspect cars.
Yeah.
And we'll optimize your routing navigation algorithm to maximize your chance of intercepting that suspect. We know where they were last sighted.
Yeah.
We like draw a net around them and we move the like interceptor cars to all of those locations. And they really liked it, but they said, listen, guys, we can't do work with academics. You have to start a company.
Yeah.
And that's why we started.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, this was like probably 2011 or so. It was like almost before Google Maps and apps.
Before Uber was really big.
Yeah.
So it was really ahead of its time.
You know, I like the fact that you guys are using that specific example, because one of the things I was thinking about on my way here, right, on the day that we're recording this, it's a rainy day in Johannesburg. When I was late for this meeting, but when I started off, you know, for where I was coming from, Google Maps told me I was going to arrive well on time, right? But along the way, it's raining. There's a lot of, you know, stoppages along the way. And you're just watching the little time, the little ETA, you know, increasing on Google Maps.
Yeah.
The application of Google Maps in our everyday lives, right? I've often thought about it I guess, machine learning. Over time, this thing learns routes and it's able to crowdsource from maybe many people's driving and navigation data. What is the most optimized route at 7:30 in the morning if you want to go to a particular place? But dynamically, you do see it changing dynamically, and it will suggest maybe a faster route along the way, all of that stuff. Where we are now, and I'm just using Google Maps, so some people use Waze, they use Apple Maps, they use Here Maps, or whatever they're using. Is that AI?
So that's a fascinating question. It's yes and it's no. So the yes is in the technical sense, because the field of artificial intelligence, I mean, was first kind of stated as AI back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was seen as this umbrella term for all the machine intelligence algorithms. And that includes machine learning algorithms, which take data in and try to predict something. So one of the things Google Maps is doing is it's taking in data of all the people it sees driving around. Mm-hmm. And it sees how long it takes them to get from place to place. And it tries to learn what is the traffic like on the different routes. And then tries to predict how long you're going to take by basically searching all the routes you could take, taking the fastest one using that estimate. And that estimate is what's called, I think it's supervised machine learning, which means there was training data. They were trained on previous days that looked like this. Mm. Maybe they trained it on days when it rained. Maybe they didn't. The person making that decision would be human.
Yeah.
But they train this model to make predictions. It's called machine learning. And it is a branch of AI.
Mm-hmm.
But since 2021, people really only call something AI if it is a machine that appears human to you, like it speaks to you, or it's got, normally they're referring to these large models that can just reply to you on something.
Yeah, and you can interact with it via text or voice. Mm. I think that's been the large distinction.
Yeah. But I mean, Google Maps, you can, right? Because it's an integrated set of technologies.
Absolutely.
There's a speech to text, there's a text to speech, then there's prediction algorithms. So it's full of AI. In reality, it's full of technologies that are technically artificial intelligence. But in the modern world, everyone only wants to talk about what's called generative AI, which is basically a model that sees a stream of data and continues it. That's basically what generative AI is.
Yeah, like what they call large language models. Mm. They're transformer-based models. Transformer is just a term of a different neural network architecture. And effectively what it's doing, it's taking in a stream of words, which they call tokens, and it's trying to predict what the next word would be. Mm-hmm. So that's, in essence, predictive analytics. That's where it comes from. But yeah, ever since 2021, it's been about Generative AI.
So Google Maps is AI for sure. There's no doubt.
100%.
But it's not, in most parts of it, are not generative AI. And they shouldn't be. This is another thing people don't realize. So it's not the best solution to every problem.
Mm.
There's a lot to traditional AI, to like machine learning, to predictive stuff, where you can actually make like error bars around your predictions, and there's no such thing as hallucination. You know, like, there's things about traditional machine learning that are still super valuable today.
Mm.
But I think generative AI is this whole other
subfield,
and it's where there's been massive developments lately. And not to bash it, I mean, it's super exciting developments. There's things that are changing everything about how you should operate a business that are coming out of generative AI. But AI is more broad than that.
All right. One of the things I love about where we are now is, I guess, making that distinction between analytics, machine learning, you know, what people consider AI, generative AI, all of these different terms that people tend to throw out there. And when, obviously, ChatGPT comes onto the scene in November 2022, it gets into the mainstream consciousness. But, you know, for people that follow the sector and are in the sector, they know that, you know, we've been at it for a long time. You even mentioned the fact that the term artificial intelligence, you know, goes back to even like the 60s and stuff like that. But one of the big things for us on this platform is the applications around AI, because for the last, I'll call it through 23 into 24, I think people are in a much better place now. But it almost felt as if people were trying to figure out, okay, how do we make use of, you know, AI in our operations? Mm-hmm. But it almost feels, if we're going to be nuanced about it, that people are trying to figure out how do they make use of generative AI, mm-hmm. you know, in their businesses. Because some of the examples that you guys mentioned just now about, you know, roadblocks and optimizing traffic and that type of thing. These are everyday things that are happening all the time where you guys have, you know, applied that AI lens, or, you know, that analytics lens, that you've been able to find the solutions. I haven't read another one on your site about the the containers. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I bought the containers, you know, saving, I think you said 15 containers, and then that's at 45,000 Rand each. And so, yeah, all of that stuff. And that's real world. So it means that businesses have been using, you know, this capability for a long time. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to get your sense of the types of projects that you guys have been working on, you know, since you guys started, since it was, you've gone from 1 week to a whole, you know, business around this. What are the things that you guys are looking at and solving on a day to day? Have you seen the discourse changing with companies? Are you guys approaching companies, you know, to say, oh, we've identified this, we think we can help you with this area? Or are companies coming to you guys to say, these are the problems we have, what can you do for us?
I think it's probably both, yeah. Where companies are coming to us and saying, look, we have this particular problem. Can we solve it using AI? Or in general, can we just solve the problem? Mm. I think we've branded ourselves in the market as problem solvers at, you know, the very core. So the businesses come to us and we assist. But we also, given that we've done so many different projects, we've actually built products. So we've abstracted from the learnings of many different projects, and we've built products which can serve a vertical. Mm. So I guess
I mean, I would add some color to that on just the demand for AI that actually makes a difference to business is so high, it's hard to satiate. We've grown since 2012 when we started as a pure consultancy. We've done no marketing. We haven't been actively pursuing growth. Mm. We're now 100 plus people. Mm. And it's just been 100% just people keep coming and they need problems solved. And when you get a reputation of, hey, that guy saved money or he made money, then when someone moves to another company, they bring someone else. And so it's almost just keeping the demand down is difficult.
That's a good problem to have.
What I think I would add, though, is in the last couple of years, being differentiated in the AI space is different to how it was before. So previously, when a company came to us, they normally would have a problem. They wanted to optimize something or they wanted to learn something. It could be anything from like TV channels coming to us and saying, when should we display which movie to get the highest viewership? Mm. And we would literally just do machine learning to predict viewership as a function of what the movie was and when you play it. Mm. All the way through to like movie studios saying dubbing time is excessive. Actually,
as you're talking, so would you going through that process maybe of how to optimize when to show what movie when? After a while, maybe you have a couple of broadcasters come to you with the same problem. You just come up with, you abstract and then you come up.
You get to a vertical. Yes, that's right. So typically that would happen. And you realize that this problem is repeatable, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, another one we did was a dubbing studio coming to us and literally saying, dubbing time is expensive. What can you do about it? That was the problem statement. And we were like, well, you know, we can take the voice signal from the person doing the dubbing and we can slightly squish some of it and slightly expand some of it so that it lines up with the lips. We can use a machine learning model to do this. And this was 2017. I mean, this was way before all this generative stuff, but there's algorithms to do that. And your dubbing time goes down by a factor of 3. So you save money. All the way to, you know, the things we've actually extended into products because we've seen so many repeat use cases is the whole document workflow in a business, normally extremely manual and labor intensive, creating a hybrid crowdsourced / machine learning model to process those things. So this could be anything from like claims to medical aids, invoice, accounts payable, and like the process around TA, so transfer agencies. And basically when you want to invest money, and you'll be surprised how much paper there is, even if it's people writing stuff, hundreds of thousands of documents coming in a day. And then when it's not people writing stuff, it's because systems don't talk to each other. So what's the way people deal with it? They print something. into a big long document and they email it to someone and then someone has to process that thing. And so we've realized that there's a lot of scope in making that process more efficient in general. And so we built a product around it.
And just to come in there deep and put some color on, you know, crowdsourcing. So it's more of not relying entirely on the machine learning algorithm or the AI, but to introduce a human in the loop, because any model has its errors. Mm. It's prone to errors.
No free lunch theorem.
Yes. It means that no algorithm will perform better than all other algorithms at every given point or situation in time. Mm. So every model, so to say, has its own strengths and weaknesses. And potentially you want to have different models predicting the same thing and coming to some consensus. So in our product, we introduce a human in the loop whenever the machine learning algorithm has a certain amount of uncertainty. So it could be like, read this form and tell me what the ID number is, for heaven's sake. And it will say my ID number is 79, what. And then all of a sudden it'll say, I'm 50% confident. And then that little piece of ID number gets cropped, anonymized, and given to a crowd of humans to be able to provide some information.
That's a deep problem with machine learning and with generative AI in general, actually. It's just not perfect.
Mm.
And that's a big challenge for businesses doing operational processes with it, because let's say you're a doctor, you're getting radiology scans done by a machine learning algorithm. The algorithm is right 95% of the time. 5% of the time, it hallucinates something completely wrong. Mm. Are you comfortable with 5% of your patients getting a wrong diagnosis? Or you're doing accounts payable and 99.9% of the time, it's perfect. It captures everything on the invoice. Mm. But 1% of the time, 0.1% of the time, it adds a zero. Are you all right with paying the wrong amount, potentially wildly incorrect, one in every 1,000 invoices that you process, if you process 10,000 a day? Yeah. So these are the real challenges with this technology that we try to address through crowdsourcing in our product. So for us, it's like we see it as you have to work together. You have to bring humans and machine together in a way that's efficient in order to solve these high accuracy problems, because these models always make mistakes. And they don't make mistakes in a predictable way. They can just randomly make a mistake. So it's one of the big challenges.
I need to ask I need to ask a business question for a moment. And when I say business question, I mean your specific business. Mm-hmm. How have you guys funded yourselves? And I ask that because the commercials around a consulting company, and then a company that's got platforms, completely different. Right. So how have you guys gone about that?
So we are 100% self-funded. Mm. You know, as our other founder, Ashley, would say, it's our customers who are investors. Mm. Because, you know, by doing good work, it means that they can go and tell somebody else, which then leads to another potential sale, et cetera, et cetera. So we have self-funded ourselves from being a pure consulting company. And then up until maybe 8 years ago when we started building product, to a product and a consulting company. So we're a bit of a hybrid company that funds itself. And, you know, the business model for the two kind of divisions is different.
And absolutely in the product, you do need capital up front. Yeah. And I guess we built that capital through the consulting revenue over time. Mm. And we invested that capital back into the products. And the nice thing about how... for us anyway, about how we did it, is super low risk, because whenever we invested in a product, we'd already solved that problem for two different customers who paid us for it. So you're kind of in a position where you're saying, well, two different people have already paid for this. Should I invest some real money now into making this a solution for the market? And it's easier to make that call when you already have paying customers than when you you just have an idea, you know? Mm-hmm. So that kind of... going from a consultancy to a consultancy with products. There's some companies have done it. I mean, like if you look at like Accenture, I think they've made similar kind of moves. Much bigger company, obviously,
but
their own problems. Palantir similar. They've got a platform. So we try to model on like this idea of we use the consultancy as a way to filter the ideas into something that's real.
It makes sense. And from a, what you call this, from a, one of the big things in technology sector is obviously getting to a point of recurring revenues of some sort. Mm-hmm. On the product side, you know, everyone and their cat is talking about SaaS, you know, those types of models. What, and I'm enjoying this because you don't often get to talk to consulting companies that have their own platforms. People tend to do one or the other. And it's only, like you said, you know, some of the bigger firms that will have that capability in-house. From a recurring revenue point of view, what's better, a repeat customer in consulting or someone who's using your product platform on a recurring basis? you can share whatever you're able to share.
I guess from our point of view, you know, consulting has its own, you know, pros and cons, where it's almost like a feast and famine model, where, you know, if you don't have enough people coming to you, you kind of need to fill productivity for the people at a fixed cost base that you've got. Whereas it's also difficult to scale consulting.
Yeah.
Especially the type of consulting which we do, which is not, hey, I'm going to give you a slide deck at the end of our engagement and say, there's your insights. Cheers.
Yeah.
Whereas we actually go the next step and actually prototype, build solutions, not just ideate, but to actually implement. So it's really difficult to scale that model.
What I can say is that those customers aren't necessarily different people, because normally what will happen is we'll have repeat consulting customers who will keep coming back for customer things. But then our products, as we build them, may become applicable to those customers as well. And normally those are your kind of best people to trial products with as well, because they have a established trust with us. They've already built a relationship with us where they are comfortable using our technology and our consultancy. And also when you're trialing a product the first time around, doing it with a customer who sees you as a consultant can be advantageous, because when the product inevitably needs to be tweaked for them, it's just another consulting engagement that they already understand. Whereas like Joe Soap on the street, who wants to use your product, has no forgiveness for you at all if it doesn't have all the features he wants. So I do think that, like, being a hybrid company the way we are has enabled us to kind of prototype faster and learn more rapidly, get feedback.
Yeah.
And then once a product is ready for a wider adoption, then you don't need to have any consulting relationship with your customers of that. And normally, though, that's a much narrower product than the kind of anything can be attached to it that you tend to sell to a customer who's also a consulting customer.
I mean, it's got its advantages and disadvantages. I think both aspects, both the product and the consulting. So I wouldn't say I prefer anyone, because, you know, ultimately revenue is revenue.
No, of course. But one of the things I'm very curious about is to say, how did you learn to be consultants? And I ask that because you're coming from academia, right? Right. When you're in an academic environment, it's completely different. It's completely different. The pressures on your time, your interface with clients, the types of things that they're willing to disclose to you, I guess even paid discussions, whatever it is, it's a completely different universe. How did you guys learn to be consultants? I'll tell you why I'm asking that question just now. A school of life.
I mean, it's just by going one step at a time, by getting by getting customers, by experiencing ridiculous deadlines, having to deliver, never failing to deliver, or, you know, getting close and having to do something about it. You know, it's like you said, timelines are completely different. In academia, it's okay to work on something for a year.
Even two.
In consulting, that's just, that would be unheard of. It cannot take that long. Also, you don't have to do original research. You can take best practices and use them. Mm-hmm. We learned all this. It's the school of hard knocks just by doing it.
Yeah, I think, like you say, the difference between academia and consulting is chalk and cheese. And, you know, with consulting, you have to realize the value quicker versus research. So that kind of drives you to
definitely have help and mentorship along the way. Yeah. And, you know, it's not just our customers. We've had mentors who've helped advise us. We've actually had employees we brought in who have had experience in consulting who've also helped us, because it's, you know, the company is not just the founders, the company is the whole group, which has evolved into being able to deliver these projects more professionally.
The reason I ask that question, I have a fascination with consulting firms, especially because you've got your traditional, you know, Bain, McKinsey, BCGs, the audit firms, your Deloitte, EY, PwC, and others. Then you've got your boutique firms across the swath. Very fascinated, because one of the things that I spend a lot of time doing is interfacing with people such as yourselves, consultants, not consultants, sorry, founders. And I found that a lot of founders, especially the ones whose businesses have scaled, and when I talk scale, I mean whether we're talking in terms of people, clients, revenue lines, or whatever it is that have scaled, or the ones that are raising big amounts of money, a lot of these founders come from the world of consulting. And over time, in interacting, you sort of almost get the sense that people that are coming out of consulting almost have they've got the playbook, right? They're not there to start a mom and pop shop. They know already how to conquer the world, right? They start off with, they are starting off by attacking the biggest thing. They're not starting off by, oh, I want to start like a small coffee shop. They're like Starbucks, right? Let's start there. How do I? And they already know how to build the system. And then it's just a matter of getting there. So it's just an observation I made in South Africa with a number of different, you know, startups that are quite prominent and where their founders come from. I've been to India as well, you know, to visit a number of startups and just talking to these founders. You're also seeing similarities. Oh, you know, what's the background? And you hear management consulting. So it's just always been a big fascination.
Yeah. I guess with us, because we were doing this math and industry study group when we were in varsity, and it gave us, you know, a lens into the different types of problems that exist, just as a consultant would go and solve many different types of problems. So I guess maybe there's
some other aspects here. Like, so the first is the type of consultancy. So we typically don't do like top level management consulting. It's more like solving a specific problem to have an impact on the bottom line or the top line. And by doing that more than 200 times now, nothing replaces experience. And I think for us, actually implementing and seeing, always being beholden to the result. I mean, we're the only company I know of where we'll actually say to our customers, don't pay us if you haven't realized value. It's bold and it's scary sometimes, but if you don't hold yourself to account for realizing value, and if you can't measure that value, then it's very difficult to kind of build a reputation in the market. So that's been our differentiator. What I would say is another thing we've always said is we've brought in people with expertise in data science, in machine learning, in AI. And the reason we've decided to do that is if you're sitting with a mobile network operator and you're sitting with their board, and if you bring in people with telecoms experience, their board already has a combined 500 years of telco experience. Now they're going to have 510 years. But if you bring in someone with data, AI experience, deep experience, I mean, our people have 10 years, that's going to add a new seat in the board that actually understands something else, different angle, and every company has data. So it's been our kind of obsession. But of course, you've got to, for me, for us, I think in general, you've got to solve a problem. You can't just give advice. Steve Jobs said, consultants see the world in 2D. They see a picture of the thing, but not the thing. And if you're running the business, you see the whole thing. So we try to see a piece of the whole thing.
I like that. In the interest of time, because I do know that I'm a little bit constrained there, I wanted to maybe bring it back to this moment that we're in AI. It has been quite fascinating just talking to you guys. There's so many more, you know, parts I would love to go down, you know, when it comes to this conversation. But this moment that we're in globally, when it comes to generative AI specifically and DeepSeek, huge, shockwaves that were sent through, you know, the ecosystem. There's a couple of things I'm curious about, you know, from you guys, especially as people that were in the sector before the hype, is three things. Firstly, the hype, right? Is the hype warranted, right? Second thing is the way that they went about teaching DeepSeek as opposed to the way that OpenAI taught ChatGPT. Do you see everyone else coming in and copying DeepSeek's homework on that front? And then the last thing, do we believe their claims? Because obviously right now, there's huge work being done, especially by American companies and American AI professionals. Obviously, they have a vested interest, but there's a huge effort to discredit, you know, what DeepSeek, you know, has done, despite the fact that they've, you know, open sourced everything and released, you know, the code, the research, all of that. So those three things.
Is the hype real? Absolutely. I didn't even think it was possible for someone to build a model like that for $5.5 million. Because, I mean, OpenAI had spent a lot of money.
Yeah. Even just Anthropic.
Yes, and Anthropic, yes. They'd spent a lot of money on buying NVIDIA GPUs in order to train these pre-trained models like ChatGPT and Claude. So for them to do it at like a fraction of that cost is super, super amazing. And the shock is warranted because it means that there is hope for people who are in different regions, i.e. Africa, to potentially build their own models, given the right type of resources. So a good friend of ours speaks about, Dr. Mark Masilla speaks about AI sovereignty. So, you know, owning our own models and our own data and, you know, distributing AI responsibly is probably a next step that we should look at, given what DeepSeek has done.
I mean, I think firstly on the hype, the reason that there's so many shockwaves is because of all the hype created by the American companies to begin with. I mean, these guys are saying, pay us hundreds of billions of dollars to invest in building models because these models are going to change everything. They're going to make new science. They're going to replace all coders around the world. SaaS is dead. Satya Nadella said that, right? No more software as a service. It's just going to be agents. So there's a lot of claims being made. And the behind that claim, they're saying it's this thing we've got here. And the thing that they've got is something called a foundation model, which you train by pouring the whole internet into a giant computer. And out comes this thing that you can fine tune to do various things, right? You can align it to various ways, but that core foundation model is super expensive. And what happened towards the end of 2024 is people started noticing that the bigger, well, firstly, they ran out of data. So you can't funnel anything else into the machine. And secondly, making the models bigger was stopping to work. So the entire economics of this was, if I make the model bigger, it's better. GPT-3 is better than GPT-2. GPT-4 is better than GPT-3. And as I go up, I have to spend billions more to fit these models, to train them. And the training run to make the foundation model is expensive. And then it was actually OpenAI, I think, maybe Google before them with some things, who really found the alternative, which is called test time scaling or inference time scaling. So basically what this is a reasoning model, so-called, where you take whatever foundation model you like and you let it think longer at the time of answering the question. And it's a completely different approach. You train it using a different kind of reinforcement learning. And some of the like results people were seeing was if you let it think 10 times longer, it's the same thing as if you trained a model 10 times bigger to begin with. But that is massively, massively disruptive, because training a model 10 times bigger would have cost $10 billion instead of $1 billion. But making it think 10 times longer does not cost that much. In fact, I can run a model locally and make it think 10 times longer or 100 times longer. And so, and in fact, there was after DeepSeek, there was a very little, there was a little hype around this, but there was a model released by guys in Stanford. They called it S1. And they took one of these reasoning models. And all that they did was every time the model was about to give an answer, they deleted the last few tokens and made it output wait. And then it carried on reasoning for a bit. And they got better results than DeepSeek and OpenAI and so on. And literally, it was a little silly little hack. I mean, what does it cost? It cost them, I think, $50 in tokens. That's what it cost them, and they got a state-of-the-art result. Mm-hmm. And why it's disruptive, why it's super cool, is all of this hype that these people are talking about, why we need money, has been flipped on its head. And it's like, why anyone can use these models if they just make it think longer? And so it's gone from system one to system two in like the Daniel Kahneman sense. So, you know, instead of fast intuitive answers, you can make take the same model. It's still pre-trained on the whole internet, right? I mean, these models like DeepSeek V3, which is the one that they trained their reasoning model on top of, it's trained on the whole internet. And there's tons of them, Llama, that these open source models. And you can spend the time to make them into reasoning models with very little effort. Or you can take a pre-trained reasoning model and weight hack it the way these S1 guys did. So you can do things now that cost you orders of magnitude less money to get just as good a result. That's why it's disruptive to the industry, to the incumbents, you know, the guys who have been spending billions. Now, guys like us can come along and hack together a model on top of something open source. And it's really it's a triumph for open source, I think, this happened. Okay. I don't know if we answered all the questions.
No, you did. Because the last thing for me, absolutely, to put a cap on this discussion is, if we're really looking big picture, where does this leave NVIDIA? I've really been thinking about this for a while, to say, because when you look at the initial market sell-off, I thought it was an overreaction, right? Because as far as I was concerned, someone had proven that NVIDIA's GPUs are actually more powerful, if more efficiently used, than what the Americans were doing. So in my head, I'm like, this is testament to the power of what NVIDIA's technology has done. Obviously, there's now questions of whether or not we'll need as many of them, you know, down the line. But I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that one.
And the true risk to NVIDIA is other chip makers.
Absolutely. Okay.
What I would say in terms of like the NVIDIA's business model, people were factoring into the price that these AI companies were going to spend hundreds of billions of dollars to train new foundation models. But what you then realize when you see that it's cheaper to run something or cheaper to get something out, there's a paradox. I think it's called Jevons paradox.
Yes, such a
so it basically just says that when something gets cheaper, the usage, the applications, the number of people who are able to take advantage of it go higher. So as we were describing now, we can go and hack a model to solve an interesting, difficult problem. And we couldn't have done that without $100 million in funding before. And because it opens up so many new applications, All those people doing their new applications are going to run these models. And the net effect is that more GPUs will be used. Mm-hmm. So more compute will be used. So I think in terms of just pure compute, more will be required. It's going to go up. Whether NVIDIA captures that whole market is a different question, because there's a whole lot of people now trying to compete in that space, but they've been really excellent at it so far. They've captured all of the software is using CUDA. They've embedded themselves. So their risk is they're playing a different game with a different risk. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what Jensen is talking about, we're going to GTC next month to watch him talk. His biggest threat seems to be from quantum computing, because that's what he keeps speaking about. And he's trying to acquire quantum computing companies because he sees the risk in like hardware. Mm-hmm. So I don't think NVIDIA has, I mean, I think if anything, open source, I'm not going to say China or America, but open source catching up in such a big way and being state of the art, as it was always going to be. I mean, I think Google wrote a paper called We Have No Moat a while back, which predicted this. Open source caught everyone. Mm-hmm. And that's a good thing, because it means everyone can apply this technology. It's not in one person's hands. But it's also a good thing for NVIDIA, because it means that more people will use their chips.
It's a democratization of AI, if you want to call it that, where anyone around the world, small companies, small businesses, can actually leverage these models to be able to specifically fine-tune them to whatever business process they have to get the desired outcome. So I think it's a big win for humanity.
So that's how we end off today's discussion. It has been a great one. I wish I could continue talking, but unfortunately, time constraints. It has been great just talking to Over King and to Darren about what's happening in the world of Isazi, which is their company, leading us through some thoughts around how the company was founded, just coming out of 1 week of work, back in the day, to realizing the impact that they were having in that 1 week, solving some of these big and deep problems and deciding to build a whole consulting firm around it that then evolved into a platform that's now developing and producing products, on top of that. And that's been in place, I believe, for the last 8 years. And they're saying that the big thing that they're working on is to say, when a problem comes to them, how do they make something cheaper? How do they make something faster? And, how do you either increase revenue for a particular business or be able to solve that particular issue? We spoke about traffic. We spoke about, containers. We even spoke about, if you're a doctor, how do you, what rate of error are you comfortable with when it comes to applying some of these models, and some of those philosophical issues. Also talking quite a bit about where businesses lie right now. Clearly the AI machine learning as well as analytics, well entrenched, but a lot of companies still grappling with the generative piece. How did they make use of that? And I think the big insight, I think Darren is the one that said it's not always the best solution, on that particular end, but the AI is always there. And also getting a nice deep explanation of how something like Google Maps, something that we're all using on a daily basis, is making use of the evolution of all of these different models to where we are now. Ending off talking about DeepSeek and why it's caused such big shockwaves. It's quite clear, from the things that both of them are saying, that the hype is warranted, the hype is real, and that there's been a huge move to democratizing the use of some of these models, and it opens up a lot of more opportunity. And over time, we'll definitely see some of NVIDIA's technologies being used a lot more. But, over time, we'll see how that business evolves and adapts to the changing environment. So that's been it. We're in conversation with two of the founders of Isazi. That's Over King and that's Darren. Gentlemen, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And that's been it for this edition of the Business Day Spotlight. Remember that you can find our latest podcast on Business Live. That's under the podcast Business Day Spotlight tab on Twitter with hashtag BD Spotlight. And remember that you can review and subscribe for free on iono.fm, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, or wherever you choose to get your pods casted. Thank you to our amazing team. I've been Mudiwa Gavaza of the Business Day and Financial Mail. And this has been another edition of the Business Day Spotlight, which is a multimedia live production. So for myself and the rest of the team, it is a good evening, good afternoon, and good morning.